This is Freedom First with Jeffrey Tucker. I would like to talk to you about a major, major problem that's confronting Western society right now. We seem to be on the precipice of a complete calamity that could involve the end of free speech, fundamental shredding of the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights, and a dramatic change in the way we communicate with each other and information generally. It's a very dangerous situation. We've talked in the past about the problem of censorship, but this is actually much more serious, and I'd like to go into some background here. The problem with censorship, as we've known from many reports and from this show, really does trace to very recent developments in the United States, mostly to 2016, when many intelligence services got involved in working very closely with universities and other third parties to manipulate algorithms on social media that would determine what you see and what you can say as a way of manipulating political outcomes. This began, frankly, with the election of Trump. After a period of great establishment panic on the part of many agencies and many other industrial interests, concerned about how it happened that this populist movement was giving rise to a guy that was an unapproved person. He was never approved to get the nomination. He certainly wasn't approved to get the presidency, and beat Hillary Clinton in the most implausible victory probably in the history of the United States, or at least since 1800. And so that sort of kicked in the censorship. But since then, it got ever more intense. And a lot of this was reflected in the elections in Britain over the Brexit issue, too, because that was another movement that was wildly successful, but wasn't supposed to happen according to establishment interests. So there began to be this very intense desire to control speech. That got worse. We know that with COVID after 2020, there was a great building and expansion of what we're calling the censorship industrial complex to involve dozens, if not 60 universities, many third-party nonprofits and NGOs, all working very closely with social media companies and mainstream corporate media to restrict what was going to be said. No criticisms of Anthony Fauci, for example, anybody who disputed masks, the merit of masks, or put down or wanted to investigate these vaccines more carefully than was being done, got throttled, banned. Twitter, before Elon Musk took it over, eliminated millions of posts, took down thousands of accounts. It was very intense. I think back on these days a lot because I was in, I think, a minority of dissidents at the time, starting quite early, actually, in January 2020. I was warning, don't lock down, don't do this, don't do that, this is a very bad idea, don't do what the CCP is doing in Wuhan, China, violating their citizens' rights, this is a disaster, don't do it. And when March came, and when the U.S. did go that direction and pursued a zero COVID strategy, I was posting a lot against it. I couldn't find anybody who really disagreed with me, and my own reach started going down and down and down. And at some point, it was very strange. I felt like I was speaking into a void, like an empty room, yelling in an empty room. Nobody could hear me. I didn't believe that you really did have federal agencies seriously involved in throttling the conversation about a matter of science and policy. I mean, that's just not what we do. I knew it'd sunk a long way, but I didn't know we'd gone that far. It's a very scary situation. So, but then over the course of the year, I found other dissidents that were with me, and gradually built a nice information infrastructure. Since that time, and that was 4 years ago now. Since that time, we have a lot of alternative venues to speak. Elon Musk has taken over Twitter. The Epoch Times is doing extremely well all over the world in its distribution. It's a source of major influence, alternative to the corporate media. Many other new television stations. We have video platforms now. NTD is doing well. So media has become more decentralized. You see what's happening here, right? So you've got government trying to ultimately control the distribution systems, just like they did in the 18th century and 19th century and early 20th century. You go after the newspaper editors, you go after the publishers, you jail them. That way you can keep people's speech from affecting the public mind. That's the goal. To curate the culture, to plan the culture, to make critics of the regime feel marginal and demoralize them, reduce their influence, and make sure that society stays stable to keep the government in the hands and industry in the hands of those who are the existing powerful people. That's the goal of all censorship. But since the censorship has become so intense over the last 4 years, I mean, to the point, really, and you know this, that most mainstream platforms are fully controlled. They might as well be branches of government. That's true for all of them, really, from LinkedIn to Facebook to Instagram, all the way to Pinterest, and all the way through. It's really quite remarkable. There are very few exceptions to this, just how pervasive this is. Well, human beings don't like to live in cages, and they don't like to live under censorship rules. As a result, we have many platforms out there now on which we can speak. That's very decentralized. None of them have the full market, but a lot of them have big markets. Epoch Times is a good example of that. But Substack is in there too, and Elon Musk with Twitter and Twitter X is trying to be the everything app. So a lot of decentralization is taking place. Now, if you're a government and you aspire to control all the distribution systems, but there's so many now everywhere, and here's the key, the censored venues are dying and the uncensored venues are growing, what are you going to do? And here's an example of that. Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook tried to come out with an alternative to Twitter. He was going to use his billions of dollars to build a censored version of Twitter, which he called Threads. And it was above the fold, promoted by every mainstream media venue. Oh, Zuckerberg's cool again. Everybody should get on Threads. It's just great. They pillaged the entire user base of Instagram, tried to get them on Threads. Well, guess what happened? It was dead within 2 weeks. I mean, when's the last time you even heard about it? It spent a lot of money. There was a huge promotion of it, and it died immediately because it doesn't matter how many billions you have, how much of the industry you control, if consumers aren't with you, it's going to die the death. And that's what happened to Threads, and this keeps happening. So now you've got what seems like an ideal situation. Oh, we're winning. We've got all these new platforms now. We're going to take a... My friends... Not so fast. Here's the problem. What we're learning. Censorship, as we saw since 2016, 2020, and all the way up to now, is merely a way station on the way towards criminalizing speech that goes against regime priorities. In other words, censorship is a way of kind of dealing with the problem, and it works so long as everything's centralized and you can censor. But when things become decentralized, the people who aspire to control the public mind and manage the cultural debate have to resort to more extreme forms, outright criminalization of dissonant opinions. And I just want to give you two examples here. One is actually very terrifying. It comes out of France. The French National Assembly has passed a law, it still has to be ratified by the Senate, so it's not through yet, but it probably will, that makes it a crime to put down or otherwise criticize approved therapeutics or medicinal strategies or technologies associated with medical things. And if you do that, you can be accused of somehow harming the Commonwealth, hurting people's health, and makes it a crime. And the penalties for violating this law would be 3 years in prison or 45,000 euros. It's probably going to go through. If it is not confirmed by the Senate in France, then they will come back again with another effort to do this. This is the goal. And you know what it's ultimately targeting, of course, is the mRNA platform of the vaccines. For reasons I do not entirely understand. Handful of very large pharma companies and distributors, manufacturers and distributors, have gained a wildly inordinate influence over many governments in the Commonwealth, on the continent, and the US. It's just true. It's unbelievable how this happened. I've written several articles on this, but I can't say even to this point that I fully understand how it came to be that pharma became so unbelievably powerful over the levers of governments in so many countries in the world. Well, France gives a good example of that. Now, the US does have a First Amendment, and a law like that in the US would probably not be very popular, so you have to use other means. So I want to turn your attention to a very interesting case that has been brewing now for 10 years in a Washington, D.C. district court. Two journalists had been responsible for criticizing a climate model that had come out of a single theorist out of the University of Pennsylvania, who's the guy who came up with a hockey stick theory based on reconstruction temperatures from the past. And our two writers went after him and said, your data doesn't hold up. We think you're falsifying your data. We think you're guilty of fraud. Nobody should pay any attention to this model. This thing is a complete hoax. If global warming is true, your model certainly does not demonstrate that. That's basically what they wrote. One had written the article for the Competitive Enterprise Institute. The other had written, Mark Stein had written an article for the National Review celebrating this article. And so it went. I mean, that's just free speech, right? The freedom of science. Here's my analysis. You have your data, your model. Here's my analysis and criticisms of what you did. What's the problem? No problem. But Michael Mann, the theorist at the University of Pennsylvania, sued them for defamation. Now, what is defamation? There's a very high bar in the law for defamation. Defamation has to prove, first of all, if you're a public figure, it's almost impossible to be defamed. You can be defamed much more easily as a private figure. Public figures, there's a much higher bar in American law. So defamation of a public figure has to prove that you knowingly told falsehoods about somebody with the intent to damage them, and the damage has to be real, like fiduciary damage, like lowering their income or reducing their status to the point. So lies told, malicious lies told to hurt somebody that in fact did hurt them. Now, you hear that, but if I asked you that question, do you think we should make it illegal for people to tell lies about things they know are lies about another person that actually end up harming them? You would probably say, yeah, that should be against the law. I mean, I think I would say that too. I mean, it sounds really, really wrong. But the problem is that in the courtrooms, and the courts have been mostly good about this, they've had a very high bar and throw out defamation cases all the time. I have friends of mine who have sued other people for defamation in the last several years. The cases are just thrown out. There's no standing, there's no proof, this is a waste of time, this is a superficial lawsuit, you know, whatever. Most defamation cases are thrown out. This one hung around in court for fully 10 years. And it was only filed 2 years after the original article was written. So we've been at this for 12 years. The problem is that every aspect of the definition of what constitutes defamation is malleable. So how do you know, for example, that I said something that I knew was wrong? So you have an opinion, I disagree with it. Okay. But what if I sincerely believe that my disagreement was correct? Okay, so that puts you in the position of having to assess objectively who was right and wrong in this. And if you decide the plaintiff was actually correct in his view, then I don't have any excuses left. Why would I disagree with something that's obviously true? I must be up to no good. Demonstrating damages is not difficult. You can just say, look, my income used to be higher than it is now. People are saying nasty things about me online. Demonstrating intent to damage is also not difficult. Why else would you criticize another person unless you wanted to, harm their reputation? You see what I mean? So on one hand, it seems as if defamation law is a good thing. On the other hand, it's really strongly subject to manipulation. In any case, this jury in Washington, D.C. decided against the defendants and made them pay respectively $1,000 and $1 million, and for the plaintiff in the case. Now, the case can be appealed, and it might be reversed, but you can see where this is heading. This is a way of criminalizing disagreement or hyperbole, or if you write a funny article about somebody that makes fun of them, you know. I mean, how do you know you're not going to get dragged up for a court? Just a few cases of successful plaintiffs in this kind of context, shutting down their critics on grounds of defamation is enough to chill free speech. I'm telling you, as a writer, you don't want to get slapped with a defamation suit. Even if you win, your court costs are long, you don't sleep at night, nobody likes litigation. It's very bad. So I suspect that this is the way this case is going to be going to go. I mean, we're going to see ever more defamation suits. In fact, the winner of the lawsuit, Michael Mann, University of Pennsylvania, wrote for the New York Times an article celebrating this. He said, "Let this put all the critics of science on notice. We're going to come after you for defamation. And not just you on the climate change issue. Every critic of science, people who criticize Anthony Fauci, are now going to be hauled for the courts and accused of defamation. People who say that wind turbines are bad for the environment or cause ill health for you, they're going to be dragged before the courts for defamation. Anybody who goes against a consensus in science is now going to be sued for defamation." This is what he said in an op-ed that ran in the New York Times. The lead opinion piece, above the fold, heralded and celebrated all over the world, an aggressive, outrageous attack on freedom of speech. So you see how this is going. This is actually very, very interesting. Defamation law has a long history in the West. For the most part, at least to my understanding, it's not been routinely abused to violate free speech rights. But if you're a government and an establishment that is very worried about your loss of control of the public mind, your loss of control of the culture of opinion and ideas in the society, to the point that something like Brexit happens again, or Trump gets elected, or some other, from your point of view, bad thing happens that dismantles the strategies of the establishment, you can now plausibly use defamation law to silence those critics and create a kind of a cartel of opinion. Very interesting, isn't it? So just one law expanded beyond plausibility by one jury can have that kind of impact. So this country is a funny country. We have the First Amendment. We believe in freedom. We believe in human rights, that sort of thing. So it's not like France, where they can do this with impunity and just make criticizing a medical treatment illegal. Can't do that in this country. But you can find surreptitious means by using what's called lawfare to go after people and chill the public debate and chill public discussion. This is what we need to be looking out for. It's not just censorship anymore. We've kind of gotten past that. The censorship is still around. We've got court cases and litigation brewing. The Supreme Court's going to be deciding about this, and I just hope that they decide the right way. But even if they do decide the right way on these cases that are before them right now concerning censorship, the censorship industry is too big, too entrenched, too all-encompassing in every part of our information infrastructure to just go away like that. It won't go away like that. It's going to be around a long time and subject to many more litigation before we get rid of it, if we ever do. But that's not even the most pressing problem. We are facing a situation now thanks to the decentralization of media and all the ways that people have innovated to get around censorship, they're going to be resorting to more brutal tactics now. The criminalizing of dissent itself. So be careful, my friends. Keep fighting for human freedom and human rights, and always put freedom first. This is Jeffrey Tucker.